17 last week. Lord willing, we'll pick up there at verse 17 through the end of the chapter and spill over a little bit into chapter 19 this morning. The theme of chapter 18 is the death of Absalom. We could say that as we end chapter 18, go into 19, it's the aftermath of Absalom's death, or Absalom's dead, now what? Because while one situation is resolved, that doesn't mean everything's resolved. There are other issues that go along with this. Of course, the first part of chapter 18, David numbered the people that were with him, divided them in three groups with three captains, gave them instructions to be gentle with the young man Absalom. They went out to battle. Scripture says that the wood devoured more than the sword, and God providentially arrested Absalom. Now, the scripture plainly says he was caught by his head. Okay? So the mule, when it got panicked, took off through a thick set of trees. His head got wedged in the branches, hair likely tangled there as well, and he's left there to dangle between heaven and earth as though rejected by heaven and rejected by earth, and await his fate. The young man that saw him told Joab, but refused to put his hand on him, knowing that Joab would eventually be the witness against him. Joab took three darts, threw them into Absalom, and then the 10 young men that bear Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and brought him to a slow and painful death. Okay? That's what we covered last week. David prudently organized his army. God providentially arrests Absalom. Joab presumes to disobey David, which results in Absalom's painful death. Okay? So we'll pick up in verse 17, and we're going to look at David personally mourns the death of his son. We'll grab verse 17 for the flow of everything. And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him, and all Israel fled everyone to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale, for he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and is called unto this day Absalom's place. And then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another's day, but this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Right? Note that phrase. We'll come back to it. Then Joab said to Cushai, go tell the king what thou hast seen. Cushai bowed himself unto Joab and ran. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, but howsoever let me, I pray thee also, run after Cushai. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing thou hast no tidings ready? But howsoever, said he, let me run. And he said unto him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushai. David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up on the roof over the gate unto the wall, and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. The watchman cried and told the king, and the king said, if he be alone, there's tidings in his mouth. And he came apace and drew near. The watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called unto the porter and said, behold, another man running alone. And the king said, he also bringeth tidings. The watchman said, methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man, and cometh with good tidings. Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, all is well. And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king, and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. The king said unto him, turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushai came. And Cushai said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee. And the king said unto Cushai, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai answered, the enemies of my lord the king, and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. The king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went thus, he said, O, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. David mourns, personally mourns, the death of his son. In verse number 17, which is kind of where we wrapped up last week, we read that after they had killed Absalom, they took him down and cast him into a great pit in the wood. Now, this is the king's son, okay? The son of the man that they're going to go back and report to after the battle. And they didn't even bring his body back for a funeral. They knew that would likely add more grief to the scenario. And so they took his body and cast it into a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. That was a shameful death. It was a shameful grave. Absalom desired honor for himself. Look at verse 18. Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale. This was some sort of a monument. Some have speculated it was a pyramid, some an obelisk. We don't know exactly what it was. But nonetheless, Absalom had left a monument by which he intended to be remembered, and likely there, either inside the monument or at the foot of the monument, he intended that to be his royal grave after his long and prosperous reign as king. Okay? Now it's interesting there that it said in the verse 18, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. Some of you will remember that in chapter 14 and verse number 27, his sons were named. Unto Absalom there were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. Okay? So apparently those sons died at a young age. There was a pretty significant infant mortality rate. And, you know, there were, just like 150 years ago in this country, when particularly young people got sick, but, you know, people get certain kinds of sicknesses, there wasn't always a way to help them. And whatever, God in His providence and likely in His judgment took those 3 sons that Absalom had. Now, he was a young man, probably, you know, no more than 30 at this time. He was plenty young enough to have taken another wife and to have more children to carry on his name. Why didn't he? Don't know. Possibly that was his way of expressing his grief. Maybe he was planning to do that after he got rid of his dad. But nonetheless, the point is this. Absalom planned a monument to himself. And God said, no, you don't. He planned to be remembered in a magnificent and a positive way, and God said, uh-uh. You're going to be buried in the woods. Nobody's going to remember where you were. Interesting. You remember when Achan had sinned and he was found out? After they stoned Achan and all his family and all his animals and everything, what do? They raised a pile of stones over him. What should have been done according to Old Testament law with a rebellious son? Should have been stoned, right? And even though he didn't get it on the front end, in essence, on the back end, he got what was coming to a rebellious son. He was buried under a pile of stones in a pile of disgrace, if you want to say it that way. And even though God didn't work on the timetable we would have liked to see, he got what he deserved. But God did it. Now, having said that, you say, well, God did it. Joab did it. Yeah, I know. Joab felt, it was interesting, Absalom disobeyed David, was disloyal to David, and caused this mess. Joab, in turn, disobeyed David to bring this mess to an end. Interesting how those things come full circle. But why was it that Joab felt the boldness to do what he did? Okay? A pragmatic reason, if you want to say it that way, a political reason, and a pragmatic reason. One, from a political standpoint, if Absalom's alive, it's never going to be over. Okay, as long as Absalom's alive, nobody can rest that this situation is dealt with. There's always the fear that he's going to do it again. And from a the political standpoint, he has rebelled against the king. He has taken the king's concubines. He's declared himself to be king. And there's no way that that's going to be reconcilable. David, as a father with maybe a blind spot for his kid, would like to. There's no way that that's reconcilable. Okay? And from a political standpoint, it needed to happen. However, from a pragmatic standpoint, if you want to say it that way, ever since David used Joab to kill Uriah, Joab felt like he had leverage over David. Okay? He could hold that over his head, and he was much more bold from that point onward. Now, if you remember, we go all the way back to 2 Samuel chapter 3. Abner came to David and said, look, Ishbosheth's not cutting it. I see where this is going. I can deliver. Now, if we were saying it today, we'd say it this way. I can deliver the vote to you to get you elected. Okay? What Abner said was, I can deliver the men of Israel. They listen to me. They're following me. I can turn them towards you. I'll bring Israel to you, and you can be the king over all Israel. David said, fine. And likely told Abner, I'll make you the captain of the host instead of Joab. What did Joab do? Killed. Okay? Joab has always had that sort of a ruthless streak about him. Okay? Now, Joab could have told himself, I don't trust Abner. I've fought against this man. I've been in battles against this man. I don't believe him. And he can say whatever he wants to say. He's just trying to set up David. And the best way I can protect David is to take out Abner. He may have told himself that, but the bottom line is he's already done this once. He did it again. He's going to do it to Amasa in chapter 20. And this was who Joab was. God used Joab in this process and then eventually judged him at the end of his life. But Joab personally went and took out Absalom. Okay? Now, that's over. It says here in verse 16, we didn't read it this morning, we'll read it now. Joab blew the trumpet and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. See, politically he was very sharp. He was very astute. He's like, okay, all that needs to happen here is we need to get rid of Absalom. We're getting rid of Absalom, we don't need to kill our countrymen anymore. We need to end this thing. As soon as Absalom was dead, he blew the trumpet, sounded the retreat, and the army came back. Then they buried Absalom. Okay? So it wasn't all heartless all the time, but when it came to certain core things, that was Joab's mentality. Okay? But Joab now has called the people back. Absalom's dead. The whole reason for fighting is over. Now somebody's got to tell David. This is a very delicate matter. Okay? It's got to be handled in a certain way. You see, verse 19, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, says, let me run, let me run, let me run. Okay? Where have we seen him before? No takers. Okay? He was one of the two sons of the priests that ran and told David, you know, this is what Ahithophel said, this is what Hushai said, get out of here, cross the river tonight. Okay? He's one that's very, very loyal to David. Okay? So this is one of those same two young men that were runners. All right, that's where we've met him before. Ahimaaz said, let me run, let me run. Now notice what he says. Let me now run and bear the king tidings how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. That's his whole focus. Okay? He is jumping up and down. We won. We won. God's delivered us. We're spared. Our prayers have been answered. This is great news. David's going to want to hear this. Boy, I want to tell him. Okay? He's young. He's naive. But that's all he could see. He couldn't see it any other way than, boy, the king's going to think this is great news. Let me go tell him. Let me go tell him. And it was customary that when a messenger would come to the king and deliver news, particularly good news, the king would often give them a gift, give them a reward. Okay? And whether he wanted that or not, or he had been one of the messengers that went and told David, get out of here now, and then he wanted to kind of close the loop and say, God's delivered us. All he could see, from his standpoint, all he thought was, well, if I go deliver this message, it's going to be great. Joab says, verse 20, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. This day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Okay? Ahimaaz knew that the king's son was dead. Okay? That becomes important a couple verses later. But Joab knew that how the message got delivered was important. Okay? This week, the current Vice President of the United States said, quote, "There's never been a day in the last 4 years where I've been proud to be his Vice President." Now, all of us would say amen. Okay? He misspoke. Can you imagine if George W. Bush or Dick Cheney had said that? How much it would have been on the news? Some of you may not have even heard that. It happened on Friday. You go to certain places on the web, you can find it. But we know what he meant to say. But how he said it, and if he had a little bobble of the tongue, it can have great ramifications. Okay? For most of America, that's just crazy Uncle Joe, and, you know, we don't worry about it too much. But in this instance, it was very critical that the message be delivered a certain way. Okay? How the message was delivered could kind of put things at ease a little bit, as much as could be, or they could really incriminate Joab. Now, we don't know this for sure, but, you know, Cushai likely was one that had been around Joab. Joab has prepared him. It may be that this is one of Joab's typical messengers. Okay? Cushai was more minded like Joab. Okay? They were similar enough in the way they thought that he trusted Cushai to deliver the message. Okay? Now, verse 21, Joab said to Cushai, "Go tell the king what thou hast seen." Cushai bowed himself and ran. The name Cushai, it could be a proper name, or it could be Cushite. Okay? Which, if it's Cushite, Cush is the Old Testament word for Ethiopia. Okay? So it could well be that he was a man of Ethiopia who was one of Joab's servants, whether he was a personal servant or whether he was his servant in the sense that he was one of his soldiers. Cushai likely was not an Israelite by birth, okay? But Cushai bowed himself and ran. Now, you remember, this battle's being fought on the eastern side of Jordan, okay? So if you're looking at your Bible map, that's on the right-hand side of the Jordan River, okay? It's a very wooded, hilly terrain, lots of gullies, lots of treacherous territory. So if he kind of traced his way back through the battlefields the way they had come, it would have kind of been slow going. Okay? And he's just going to deliver the message. Verse 22, "Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, howsoever, let me, I pray thee, run also after Cushai." I mean, you can see this, can't you? "I want to go too. I want to go too. I want to go too." I mean, it's that youthful exuberance. "Son, I've already tried to tell you." "Not today. Please, let me go. I want to go." All right? And finally, he wears Joab down. Joab's like, "All right, bud, I'm trying to protect you here. If you won't let me help you, I'll let you learn the hard way." Verse 22, "Let me run, I pray thee, after Cushai." Joab said, "Wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing thou hast no tidings ready?" Okay, the word "ready" there carries with it the idea of to find. Okay, and I think what he means is you don't have tidings that are going to find favor with the king ready. The only message you have ready is the Lord's vengeance of our enemies. That's not going to find favor with the king the way you think it is, Ahimaaz. Just trust me on this one. Who knew David better, Ahimaaz or Joab? Joab did. Okay? Who knew the entire political landscape better? Joab did. Okay? And Joab knew what needed to happen. But sometimes, if a messenger brought bad news, it could bring a violent reaction from a king who could do whatever he wanted to do. It may be if one of the servants was killed or punished for a bad message, you know, that could have been part of the process too. But the bottom line is, he said, "Look, you don't have tidings ready, or at least you don't have tidings ready that will find an audience with the king." Okay? Verse 23, "Howsoever," said he, "let me run." He's like, "Fine, get out of here. Quit bothering me. I got other things to do. Go, run, get out of here." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain. Okay? The plain There, it's a term there that's usually used of the plains near Jericho, which would be on the western side of, you know, what is modern day Israel, and the western bank, you know, the West Bank, the disputed Palestinian areas. But it also just generally refers to the area near the river, the plain near the river that would have been more flat, as opposed to the wooded, hilly area where the battle was fought. Okay? So, Ahimaaz took a different route that was closer to the Jordan River. Okay? Now, he was motivated. He was young. He was energetic. He wanted to run. And you know how it is. Well, maybe you don't. But, you know, some of you do. If he's running and I'm running, I'm going to beat him. Okay, that's all there is to it. Okay, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to get there before he does. That was Ahimaaz's mindset. Now, maybe, just maybe, he was a very fast runner and proud of it. And he's going to show it off. He probably was just genuinely felt like, this is going to be a great day and I'd love to be a part of the day. But he ran the way of the plain. That's why I said if Cushai went the other way through the battlefield, then it would have been slower going. Maybe they both took the same route, but just the fact that he said he went by the way of the plain indicates that they took two separate paths to get back to the city of Mahanaim where David was. Okay? Verse 23, then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushai. That is, he outran him. He got there first. Verse 25, the watchman cried and told the king, Verse 24, the watchman went up to the roof and said, behold, a man running alone. And the king said, if he be alone, verse 25, there's tidings in his mouth. Okay? Have you really thought about the significance of that? Okay? If he's alone, he's a messenger. I never thought much about it. I just kind of buzzed over it. But the truth is, if the army had been beaten and they were all in a retreat to get back to the safety of the city, there would have been a crowd coming. The fact that it was one runner running by himself indicated it was a messenger, and that in and of itself was better news than a retreat. Okay? So he said, is one man running alone? There's tidings in his mouth. Okay? Verse 26, the watchman saw another man running. The watchman called unto the porter, behold, another man running alone. You got the city gate here, okay? There's an outer gate, an inner gate, and kind of a space in between. There is a room up above the gate, which was the watchman's tower. And he could even go up on the roof to get the highest spot to see the furthest. And so you got the watchman up on the roof calling down to the porter, the man guarding the gate, who's relaying the message to the king. Okay? Hey, there's another runner coming. All right? There's tidings in his mouth. Verse 27. The watchman said, methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. Notice what David said. Well, first of all, let me just catch this real quick. I think he runs like Ahimaaz. Apparently there was something distinctive about his style. Okay? There are people that walk a certain way, and even if you can't see their face, you can pretty much tell who it is. There's people that run a certain way. You know, some people have a very nice form, very smooth. Maybe they're very fluid, very fast. And other people run, and it looks like a human cyclone. Okay? Ahimaaz probably was more graceful, but there was something distinctive about it. They could tell who it was. And notice what the king says. He is a good man and brings good tidings. Okay? Zadok, this is part of how the theory works here. Zadok, the son of the priest, he was a good man. He was a loyal man, but he was part of the priest family. So, generally, you would send a higher ranking messenger with good news. Okay? So he's thinking, all right, it's good news coming. Verse 28, Ahimaaz called unto the king, all is well, and he fell down on the earth upon his face before the king and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hands against my lord the king. It's interesting, the son of the priest is reinforcing the point that God is the one that gave this great victory. He recognized that. How long did he have? He had several miles, no doubt, to think about it, to run it over in his mind, but he greeted David that way, expecting that David would receive it well. The Lord thy God has delivered up the men which lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And he's expecting him to have an expression of relief, a smile on his face, some sort of an expression of joy. And good, boy, this is good news. I mean, you think about it. There are those right now who are so intensely paying attention to our election cycle. Their whole life is wrapped up in that. And whether it be a local candidate, a state candidate, national candidate, I mean, they're very intensely paying attention. And if it goes the way they hope it does, boy, then everything's right with the world. Okay? That's where Ahimaaz is. He's expecting, boy, this is the best possible outcome. David's going to rejoice. Well, it didn't happen that way. The first word out of David's mouth, the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Literally, is there shalom? Is there peace to Absalom? Is he well? Now, that had to just smack him in the face. Whoa, I wasn't expecting this. And maybe things kind of go into slow motion, and he figures out, this is why Joab didn't want me to come. Okay? And notice what he said. When Joab sent the king's servant and me, thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. Right? That may be true. He may not have actually seen the death of Absalom, but he knew he was dead. Verse 19, verse 20, you're not going to go today because the king's son is dead. He knew he was dead. All right? So when he realized, all right, this wasn't received the way I thought it was going to be received, he backs off a little bit. I saw a big tumult, but not exactly sure everything that happened there. And the king said unto him, turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushai came. Now you got a picture of this. Okay? He's coming up to the gate. He bows down before the king. The Lord's avenged you of your enemies. Is Absalom safe? There's a big tumult. I don't know. All right, this whole conversation takes 2 minutes. Now, if it's a fairly flat spot there where Mahanaim is, you see somebody running. How long is it going to take him to get here? Well, no, it depends on how fast he is, right? I mean, he's also tired. He's at the end of a long run. And so, how long did Ahimaaz have to just stand there? A couple minutes? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? In his mind, he's going, Cushai, I knew you were slow. That's why I knew I could beat you, but now I wish you'd hurry up. You know? Come on, come on, come on. So they're just standing there waiting, and here comes Cushai. And Cushai came and said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee. He invokes the name of the Lord, but it's more from a standpoint of vengeance, more the military aspect. The king said unto Cushai, is the young man Absalom safe? Again, the same question. Is there peace to Absalom? Is he okay? Cushai answered, and boy, this was a great answer. This was exactly why Joab sent Cushai. Now, he had several miles worth of jogging to think about it. Roll it over in his mind, get all the words exactly right, say exactly what he wanted to say. But when he got there, he said, the enemy of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. It's expressed as a wish or even as a curse sort of a thing. Basically what he's saying is, I wish all the enemies of the king were in the same condition as that young man. That told him what he wanted to know. He wished that all the king's enemies were dead. Absalom's dead. Okay? But all he said was, the king's son is dead. He didn't say anything about who did it, how it happened, where is he now. He left all of those details out. That's what Joab wanted. He just wanted him to break the ice, and then when Joab comes, then he'll deal with the rest of it. Okay? Now, you've got David's response. And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, oh, my son Absalom. Now, I'm not reading it anywhere near how it would have been. Okay, remember, David is a Jewish man. They're very emotional. David was on the emotional end of that spectrum. Okay, read the Psalms. If he's high, he was really high. If he was low, he was really low. And when this hit him, this is what he's been dreading. It's interesting to see the parallel between this in 1 Samuel chapter 4 or 5, when Eli is sitting waiting to hear what happened to the ark. Remember, his two sons took the ark to the battlefield, and it says his heart trembled for the ark. God's already told him he's going to judge his two sons. And he pretty much figured, all right, my sons, they're done. Okay? But it says his heart trembled for the ark. I mean, this is a parallel here. David, his heart trembles. But you know what? A lot of times we don't factor into this equation. It's easy to look at this and say, David was so blinded by an emotional attachment to his son that he couldn't see that he was rebellious and that he needed to go and all these kind of things. Maybe. But I think that this was even more a part of it. We go to David's personal mourning, but then we get in the first couple of verses of 19, chapter 19, we're also going to see David's personal guilt. And it was told Joab, behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom. The victory that day was turned into mourning, chapter 19, verse 2, unto all the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. People got them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. Verse 33, it says the king went up to the chamber over the gate. As the army's coming back to the city, David's still up in the chamber weeping over his son. Okay? But I think there's a bigger picture here than just a personal attachment. I don't know how many people knew at this point. But the prophet Nathan, it's recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 12, pointed his finger in his face, said, Thou art the man, and God's going to judge you fourfold. Number one, the baby died. Number two, Amnon died at the hands of Absalom. And I think this whole time, David is fearful that this is going to be number three. He knows that God has pronounced judgment. He knows that it's coming at some point, and he's dreading the judgment of God. Later on, you remember what happened with the baby? He fell down and wept and cried, and then when he found out the baby was dead, he got up, cleaned himself up, and said, give me something to eat. And his reasoning was this. He said, who knew whether God would be merciful. Okay? But now I know that he's gone to be with the Lord and I'll go to be with him one day. Okay? He didn't demonstrate that same attitude here. In that, there was an acknowledgement of God's in control. And I'm accepting the will of God. I'm submitting to that. He didn't demonstrate the same thing here. Okay? He grieved over it. Maybe he grieved over the fact that he felt like his son was lost. He was a very irreligious man. Maybe. But I can't help but think there's a huge element of personal guilt here. David is sitting there thinking all day long, it's my fault. I know he made his own choices. I know it was his decision, but part of this is my fault. Part of this is the judgment of God on my family, and it's my fault. I mean, he was even thinking that back in chapter 15 and 16 when they're leaving Jerusalem. He said, basically saying, look, let God do what he wants to do. I mean, I know God said he's going to spank me. Maybe this is how. And he was, I can't help but think that's a part of it. Did he have a blind spot for Absalom? Yeah. Okay. Did he have a fatherly love? Yeah. Nobody would have begrudged him a time of weeping and mourning because his son was dead. Okay. You can't totally eliminate that. But the messengers ran ahead of the army. He had some time, even probably a few hours, to digest the message and weep. But the fact that he was still weeping when the army got back, he needed to pull it together and separate his personal emotions from his public responsibilities. Okay? And he didn't do that. But I really honestly believe that a large part of that had to do with his own personal guilt in scourging himself for saying, this is my fault. It would have been interesting if somebody could have quoted to him Job chapter 8, Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression. This is one of Job's friends saying, look, if the kids sinned and God put them away for their sin, God's just in what he did. Somebody needed to quote that to David and say, look, if God judged your son, God's not unjust in what he did. Okay? But David is still mourning and weeping. There's a personal grief because it's his son. I think there's a guilt that nobody really knew. We have the benefit of hindsight and the benefit of Scripture. I don't know how many people at this time really understood how much of a burden of guilt he was bearing. That it's my fault. And as a parent, you know, you if you know you messed up, it's hard to just factor that out. Okay, it's easier to do it with somebody else's kid, right? Well, they should have known better. You know, that's human nature. But the reality is David's grieving, but he needs to separate his personal from his public. And he's not doing it. That's an interesting statement there in verse number 3. The people got them by stealth into the city as people being ashamed steal away when they flee into battle. They're all marching back. You can imagine there's a bubbly conversation. The Lord's delivered us. And then as they approach the gate, they hear the wailing. The wailing of grief. What's that? That's David. Why? Absalom. You've got to be kidding me. Right? Well, then the word starts to trickle back all the way through the army. You know the old expression, news travels fast and bad news travels faster. And that's what's happening. The word's going back. And so the people that are all excited and rejoicing, all the air's let out of their balloon. They get to the city and they kind of duck their head and try to slide in unnoticed. It says, as those who steal away in battle, they're acting ashamed as though they've done something worthy of reproof. They've done something shameful. If people flee away in battle, they did it to save their life, but they're still ashamed that they didn't have the courage to stay and fight. We lost. And so in essence, they are treating it as though they lost, even though they won. And that was due to David's leadership here. David's personal guilt. Here's an interesting observation about David's situation here. Forgiveness and consequences can coexist at the same time. What do I mean by that? 2 Samuel chapter 12, this is about verse 12 or 13. David said, I've sinned. And Nathan comes back and says, yes, and the Lord has put away your transgression. He's covered your sin. He said, your transgression is forgiven. You will not die. However, the sword will never depart from your house. You're going to pay fourfold, those kind of things. So David knew he was forgiven. God is not judging David personally in the sense of, his sin for having Uriah killed has been forgiven. His sin of adultery has been forgiven by God. He's not going to die. So you have forgiveness. David can live in the assurance of that. Psalm 51, Psalm 32. Blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is he unto whom the Lord will not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile. Okay? He had forgiveness and he knew it. And at the same time, he was dealing with the consequences that would not be reversed, even though his personal forgiveness had been attained. Interesting how God's doing all of these things at one time. I mean, we tend to look at it one little slice. All of these things are going on together at the same time. Verse 5, we see Joab's powerful rebuke. Joab came into the house to the king and said, thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, in the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters, in the lives of thy wives and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceived that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. Dr. Finch, tremendous bedside manner, right? Yeah. I mean, this is the guy that you want to come in and tell you, yeah, it's serious. No. Okay? But that kind of gives you a little insight into why he wanted Cushai and not Ahimaaz to be the messenger, right? Joab comes in and he tells it like it is. Now, everything that he said was true. And Joab felt a certain boldness because they were family. Okay, so Joab's his nephew. They're family. And Joab has been with him a long time. He's the captain of the host. They have been personal friends. He's the one with the position to do this, and he felt a certain boldness, but he could have delivered it a little different way, right? I'm not disputing that what he said was true. It could have been delivered in a little more respectful way. Nonetheless, Joab came in and just, bam. Let me just tell you, this is what you need to do. Verse 7, now therefore arise, go forth, and speak comfortably unto thy servants, for I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry with one with thee this night, And that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. Joab's been with David pretty much from his youth until now. And he said, David, you think you've seen problems. You've seen Saul. You've seen Absalom. You've seen, you know, getting trapped in Gath. All the things that we could list, he said, that's not going to be the worst thing you've ever dealt with if you don't snap out of it, buddy. And it was true. But, you know, there's almost a threat there. Who was the captain of the host? Joab. Joab felt like, I've got enough pull with these people that if I go and leave, they're coming with me. I think, I can't help but think that threat's implied there too. But what he said was true. The people expected the king to congratulate them and to thank them. That was the pattern. If the king didn't go to the battlefield, nonetheless, when the victorious army would come home, the king would greet them and congratulate them and thank them and honor them for risking their lives in defense of the king and in defense of the people. None of that happened. They were made to feel like they were felons. Okay? They were shamed. And he said, look, if the people desert you now, you are really toast. And David's politically in a precarious situation. Absalom's rebelled against him and Israel's thrust him out. Okay? He has a core group of people that are around him. But if that core group of people leave, he's in trouble. And it's true. If Absalom had been victorious, David would have been killed. Every one of his wives and concubines and children would have been killed. It would have been a massacre. And the reality is, David, I know you're grieving over Absalom. Look at your 25 other kids. They're still alive. Look at your wives. They're still alive. You got to think about that too. Now, was that a difficult thing? Yes. But it was needed. That, you know, sometimes we like to just focus in on one little thing. And we need to be reminded, hey, there's a bigger picture. David needed that. Joab was the messenger. David, I'm sure, did not like to be treated the way he was treated. He was the king. He wasn't used to being treated that way. But nonetheless, David was humble enough to listen and to say, you know what? You know, what you're saying is true. Even if I don't like the way you said it, what you said was true. Verse 8, the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told unto all the people, saying, behold, the king doth sit in the gate. And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent. If Israel fled every man to his tent, likely was referring to those that had followed Absalom. Okay? They all went home. But the word got out, the king sitting in the gate, all the people gathered to hear the king, and what is unspoken here is that David likely then thanked them, congratulated them, and did what he should have done, even though he's personally grieving. I mean, there's times when that happens for all of us. And there are times, whatever ministry you have, whether it's simply the ministry of comforting another brother or sister in this church, if it's never a public ministry, there's times when you bear a weight, and you got to bear that weight and still take care of other responsibilities. As parents, we bear weights, and we don't want to let the kids in on it right now. We just got to deal with it, and life's still got to function in the house. And this is a perfect example. Things had to be done. But what David viewed as a negative ultimately was a positive. What he viewed as a horrible tragedy was, in essence, the blessing of God. Because now that Absalom's out of the way, now the kingdom can be restored to David. Even though he wasn't thinking that way at the time. What's the takeaway from all of this? God's in control. God's in control. God doesn't always give us the outcome we were hoping for or the one, you know, that we would have even pulled for. But God's in control. And just like David did when the baby died, David right now with Absalom needs to understand God's still in control. And he allowed things to happen in the order he did. God is restoring the kingdom to David, even if he can't see it for his grief right now.